No matter, I didn't require one. The whole thing was ancient history now. I was happy being alone. Eleanor Oliphant, sole survivor. That's me. I'm going to go home now, Raymond, I said, standing up quickly. I'm going to get a taxi.
Good idea,
he said, finishing his drink. He took out his phone.
But you're not going to wander the streets on your own and try to hail one, not at this time of night. I'll call you one. Look, I've got an app.
He showed me his phone, beaming.
What am I supposed to be looking at?
I said, peering at the screen. He ignored me and checked the message.
I'll be here in 5 minutes, he said.
He waited with me in the hall until the cab arrived, then walked me to the vehicle and held the door open for me. I saw him peering in at the driver, a middle-aged woman who looked tired and bored as I climbed into the back seat.
Are you coming too?
I said, wondering why he was hesitating on the curb. He checked his watch, ruffled his hair and looked from the house to the taxi and back again.
Nah, he said. I think I'll hang around here for a bit. You'll see what happens.
I turned to watch him as the car moved off. He staggered slightly as he walked up the path, and I saw Laura, framed in the doorway, two glasses in her hands, one of them offered out to him. Chapter 18. Raymond sent me an electronic mail message at work the next week. It was very odd, seeing his name in my inbox. As I'd expected, he was semi-literate.
Hi, E. Hope all good with you. Got a wee favour to ask. Sammy's son Keith has invited me to his 40th this Saturday. Ended up staying late at that party, BTW. It was a right laugh. Fancy being my plus one? It's at the golf club. There's a buffet. No worries if not. Let me know. R.
A buffet? In a golf club? The Lord giveth and the Lord taketh away. And two parties in a month. More parties than I had been to in 2 decades. I hit reply. Dear Raymond, I should be delighted to accompany you to the birthday celebration. Kind regards, Eleanor Oliphant, Ms. Moments later I received a response, a smiley face. 21st century communication. I fear for our nation's standards of literacy. I had arranged to have the afternoon off that day for my appointment at the hairdresser's, but ate my lunch in the staff room first as usual, with a Telegraph crossword, a tuna and sweet corn bloomer, salt and vinegar crisps, and orange juice with bits. I must thank the musician in due course for introducing me to the pleasure of bits. After this delicious repast, and with a small grin of triumph at the thought of my colleagues having to remain behind at their desks for the rest of the afternoon, I took a bus into town. Heliotrope was in a smart street in the city centre, on the ground floor of a Victorian sandstone building. It was certainly not the sort of place I'd usually frequent. Loud music, aggressively fashionable staff, and far too many mirrors. I imagined this might be where the musician went for a haircut, and that made me feel slightly better about it. Perhaps one day we'd be sitting side by side in those black leather chairs, holding hands under the hairdryers. I waited for the receptionist to finish her phone call and stepped away from the huge vase of white and pink lilies on the counter. Their smell snagged in the back of my throat, like fur or feathers. I gagged. It wasn't something meant for humans. I'd forgotten how noisy hairdresser salons were, the constant hum of dryers and inane chat, and positioned myself in the window seat, having donned a black nylon kimono which, I was alarmed to see, was already sprinkled with short hair clippings snipped from a previous client. I quickly brushed them off. Laura arrived, looking just as glamorous as before, and led me towards a seat in front of a terrifying row of mirrors.
"Did you have a good time on Saturday?"
she said, fussing around with a stool until she was seated behind me at the same height. She didn't look at me directly, but into the mirror, where she addressed my reflection. I found myself doing the same. It was strangely relaxing.
"I did," I said,
It was a splendid evening. "Dad's doing my nut in already, staying in the spare room," she said, smiling, "and I've got another 2 weeks of it. I don't know how I'll cope." I nodded. "Parents can certainly be challenging, in my experience," I said. We exchanged a sympathetic glance. "Now then, what are we doing for you today?" she said, unfastening the rubber band at the bottom of my braid and fanning it out. I stared at my reflection. My hair was mousy brown, parted in the centre, straight, and not particularly thick. Human hair, doing what human hair does, growing on my head. "Something different," I said. "What would you suggest?" "How brave are you prepared to be, Eleanor?" Laura asked. This was the correct question. "I am brave. I am brave, courageous Eleanor Oliphant." "Do whatever you want," I said. She looked delighted. "Colour too?" I considered this. "Would it be a normal human hair colour? I don't think I'd like pink or blue or anything like that." "I'll give you a shoulder-length, lightly layered, choppy bob with caramel and honey pieces woven through and a long, sweeping fringe," she said. "How does that sound?" "It sounds like an incomprehensible pile of gibberish," I said. She laughed at my reflection and then stopped, perhaps because I wasn't laughing. "Trust me, Eleanor," she said earnestly. "It'll be beautiful." "Beautiful is not a word normally associated with my appearance," I said, highly sceptical. She patted my arm. "Just you wait," she said gently.
"Miley!" she screeched, almost causing me to fall from my chair. "Come and help me mix up some colour!"
A short, chubby girl with bad skin and beautiful eyes came trotting up. Laura gave a prescription involving percentages and codes which might as well have been for gunpowder.
"Tea, coffee, magazine?" Laura said.
I could scarcely believe it when I found myself, 5 minutes later, sipping a cappuccino and perusing the latest edition of OK magazine. Look at me, I thought.
"Ready?" Laura asked. Her hand, warm and soft, brushed against the back of my neck as she took the hank and heft of my hair and twisted it into a rope behind me. The slow noise of the scissors slicing through it was like the sound of ember shifting in a fire, tinkly, dangerous. It was over in a moment. Laura held the hair aloft, a triumphant Delilah. "I'll cut it properly after the colour's done," she said. "We just need a level playing field at this stage." Because I was sitting motionless, it didn't feel any different. She dropped the hair on the floor where it lay like a dead animal. A skinny boy who looked like he'd rather be doing almost anything else was sweeping up very, very slowly and nudged my hair creature into his dustpan with a long-handled brush. I watched his progress round the salon in the mirror. What happened to all the hair afterwards? The thought of a day's or a week's worth bundled into a bin bag, the smell of it and the soft, marshmallowy pillowing of it inside made me feel slightly queasy. Laura approached, wheeling a trolley, then proceeded to daub various thick paste onto selected strands of my hair, alternating between bowls. After each section of gunk was applied, she folded the painted hair into squares of tinfoil. It was a fascinating procedure. After 30 minutes, she left me sitting with a foil head and a red face, then returned, pushing a hot lamp on a stand which she placed behind me. 20 minutes and you'll be done," she said.
She brought me more magazines, but the pleasure had waned. I had quickly tired of celebrity gossip, and it seemed that the salon didn't take Witch or BBC History, much to my disappointment. A thought kept nudging me, and I ignored it. Me, brushing someone else's hair. Yes, someone smaller than me, sitting on a chair while I stood behind and combed out the tangles, trying my best to be gentle. She hated the snags and tugs. Thoughts of this type, vague, mysterious, unsettling, were precisely the sort that vodka was good for obliterating, but unfortunately I'd only been offered a choice of tea or coffee. I wondered why hair salons didn't provide anything stronger. A change of style can be stressful after all, and it's hard to relax in such a noisy, bright environment. It would probably encourage customers to give bigger tips, too. Tipsy equals tips, I thought, and laughed silently. When the buzzer sounded on the heat lamp, the colour mixing girl came over and led me to the backwash, which was, by any other name, a sink. I allowed the tin foil to be unwrapped from my hair. She ran warm water through it, and then shampooed it clean. Her fingers were firm and deft, and I marvelled at the generosity of those humans who performed intimate services for others. I hadn't had anyone else wash my hair since as far back as I could remember. I suppose Mummy must have washed it for me when I was an infant, but it was hard to imagine her performing any tender ministrations of this type. After the shampoo was rinsed away, the girl performed a shiatsu head massage. I have never known such bliss. She kneaded my scalp with firm tenderness and precision, and I felt the hair stand up in my forearms, then a bolt of electricity run down my spine. It ended about 9 hours before I would have liked it to. "You had a lot of tension in your scalp," she said sagaciously, while she rinsed out the conditioning cream. I had no idea how to respond, and opted for a smile, which serves me well on most occasions. Not if it's something to do with death or illness, though. I know that now. Back in the same chair, my shorter, coloured hair combed out, Laura returned with her sharp scissors. "You can't see the colour properly when it's wet," she said. "Just you wait." In the end, the cutting only took 10 minutes or so. I admired her dexterity and the confidence with which she undertook the task. The drying took much longer, with considerable and elaborate hairbrush action. I read my magazine, electing, at her prompting, not to look up until the styling was finished. The dryer was switched off, chemicals were sprayed, lengths and angles were examined, and a few additional snips undertaken here and there. I heard Laura's laugh of delight. "Look, Eleanor," she said. I raised my head from Marie Claire's in-depth report into female genital mutilation. My reflection showed a much younger woman, a confident woman, with glossy hair that brushed her shoulders and a fringe that swept across her face and sat just over her scarred cheek. "Me?" I turned to the right and then to the left. I looked in the hand mirror Laura was holding behind my head so that I could see the back, smooth and sleek. I swallowed hard. "You've made me shiny, Laura," I said. I tried to stop it, but a little tear ran down the side of my nose. I wiped it away with the back of my hand before it could dampen the ends of my new hair. "Thank you for making me shiny." Chapter 19. Bob had called me in for a meeting. He stared at me when I went into his office. I wondered why.
"Your hair,"
he said, eventually, as though guessing the answer to a question. I hadn't found it easy to style this morning, but I thought I'd made a fair attempt. I put my hands to my head. "What's wrong with it?" I said.
"Nothing's wrong with it. It looks nice," he said, smiling and nodding.
There was a moment's awkwardness. Neither of us was used to Bob commenting on my appearance.
"I had it cut," I said, obviously.
He nodded.
"Sit down, Eleanor."
I looked around. To say Bob's office was untidy was rather to understate the degree of chaos in which it was always to be found. I lifted a pile of brochures from the chair which faced his desk and placed them on the floor. He leaned forward. Bob has aged very badly during the time that I've known him. His hair has almost all fallen out, and he has put on quite a lot of weight. He looks rather like a dissolute baby.
"You've worked here for a long time, Eleanor," he said.
I nodded. That was factually correct.
"Did you know that Loretta is going off on leave for the foreseeable?"
I shook my head. I am not interested in the petty tittle-tattle of quotidian office life. Unless it's gossip about a certain singer, of course. I can't say I'm surprised, I said. I always doubted her grasp of the basic principles of value-added tax. I shrugged. So perhaps it's for the best.
Her husband's got testicular cancer, Eleanor, he said. She wants to look after him.
I thought about this for a moment. That must be very difficult for them both, I said. But if detected early enough, the survival and recovery rates for cancer of the testes are good. If you're male and you are unfortunate enough to get any sort of cancer, that's probably the best type to have. He fiddled with one of his fancy black pens.
So, he said, I'm going to be needing a new office manager for the next few months at least.
I nodded. Would you be interested, Eleanor? It'd mean a bit more money, a bit more responsibility. I think you're ready for it, though. I considered this. How much more money? I asked. He wrote to someone a post-it note, tore it from the pad, and passed it across to me. I gasped.
In addition to my current salary?
I had visions of taking taxis to work rather than getting the bus, of upgrading to Tesco finest everything, and of drinking the kind of vodka that comes in chunky, opaque bottles.
No, Eleanor, he said. That amount would be your new salary.
Ah, I said. If that were the case, then I would need to consider the risk-slash-reward ratio carefully. Would the increase in salary compensate adequately for the increased amount of tedious administration work I'd be required to undertake, the augmented levels of responsibility for the successful functioning of the office, and, worse still, for the significantly increased degree of interaction that I'd need to undertake with my colleagues?
May I take a few days to consider it, Bob? I said.
He nodded.
Of course, Eleanor, I expected you to say that.
I looked at my hands.
You're a good worker, Eleanor, he said.
How long has it been now? 8 years?
9, I said. 9 years, and you've never had a day off sick, never used all your annual leave. That's dedication, you know. It's not easy to find these days.
It's not dedication, I said. I simply have a very robust constitution and no one to go on holiday with. He looked away, and I stood up, ready to leave.
He cleared his throat. Oh, one other thing, Eleanor. Because Loretta's so busy preparing all the handover stuff, could I ask you to help out with something?
Ask away, Bob, I said.
The office Christmas lunch. Do you think you could organise it this year? He said. She won't have time before she finishes up, and I've already had people in my office whinging that if we don't book somewhere now,
they'll end up in Wetherspoons, I said, nodding.
Yes, I'm familiar with the issues, Bob.
If you wish it, I'd certainly be willing to organise the lunch. Do I have carte blanche with regard to venue, menu and theme?
Bob nodded, already busy at his computer again.
Sure, he said. The company will chip in a tenner per head. After that, it's up to you guys to choose where to go and how much extra you want to pay.
Thank you, Bob, I said. I won't let you down.
He wasn't listening, engrossed with whatever was on his screen. My head was buzzing. 2 major decisions to make. Another party to go to. And handsome, talented Johnny Lomond, chanteur extraordinaire and potential life partner on the horizon. Life was very intense. When I sat back down at my computer, I stared at the screen for some time, not actually reading the words. I felt slightly sick at the thought of all the dilemmas I faced, to the extent that, although it was almost lunchtime, I had no desire to buy and eat my meal deal. It might be helpful to talk to someone about it all, I realised. I remembered that from the past. Apparently talking was good. It helped to keep anxieties in perspective. People had kept saying that. Talk to someone. Do you want to talk about it? Tell me how you feel. Anything you want to share with the group, Eleanor. You do not have to say anything, but it may harm your defence if you do not mention when questioned something which you later rely on in court. Miss Oliphant, can you tell us in your own words what you recall of the events that took place that evening? I felt a tiny trickle of sweat run down my back, and a fluttering in my chest like a trapped bird. The computer made that annoying ping which indicates the arrival of an electronic message. I clicked on it without thinking. How I despise these Pavlovian responses in myself.
Aye, you still on for Saturday? Meet you at the station and we can get the train out to Keith's party. Eight-ish.
Or.
He had attached a graphic. A photograph of a famous politician's face next to a headshot of a dog that looked exactly like him. I snorted. The resemblance was uncanny. Underneath he'd written,
Wednesday morning, LOLs. Whatever that meant.
Impulsively, I typed straight back. Good morning, Raymond. The canine-slash-ministerial graphic was most amusing. Would you happen to be free for lunch at 12:30 by any chance? Regards, Eleanor. There was no reply for almost 15 minutes, and I began to regret my impulsive decision. I hadn't ever invited anyone to join me for lunch before. I conducted my usual online checks for any updates from the musician. There was nothing new on Facebook, Twitter, or Instagram, sadly. It made me feel anxious when he went quiet. I suspected it meant he was either very sad, or perhaps more worryingly, that he was very happy. A new girlfriend? I felt queasy and was thinking that perhaps I wouldn't go for the full meal deal today, just an antioxidant smoothie in a small bag of wasabi peanuts, when another message arrived.
Soz. Had to deal with a help desk call. Told them to switch it off and switch it back on again, LOL.
Yeah, lunch would be good. See you out front in 5?
R.
I hit reply. That would be fine. Thank you. Daringly, I didn't put my name, because I realised he'd know it was from me. Raymond was late, arriving in 8 rather than the promised 5 minutes, but I decided not to make anything of it on this one occasion. He suggested we went to a cafe he liked around the corner. It wasn't the sort of place I would normally frequent, being rather bohemian and shabby-looking with mismatched furniture and a lot of cushions and throws. What was the likelihood of them being laundered on any sort of regular basis, I wondered? Minimal at best. I shuddered at the thought of all those microbes, the warmth of the cafe and the dense fibres of the cushions would be a perfect breeding ground for dust mites, and perhaps even lice. I sat at a table with ordinary wooden chairs and no soft furnishings. Raymond seemed to know the waiter, who greeted him by name when he brought the menus. The staff seemed to be the same sort of person as him, unkempt, scruffy, badly dressed, both the men and the women.
The falafel's usually good, he said, or the soup,
pointing to the specials board. Cream of cauliflower and cumin, I said, reading aloud.
Oh, no. No, I really don't think so.
I was still in gastric turmoil after my meeting with Bob, and so I simply ordered a frothy coffee and a cheese scone. Whatever Raymond was eating smelled disgusting, like gently reheated vomit. He ate noisily with his mouth partially open, so that I had to look away. It made it easier to broach the subject of Bob's offer and the task he had entrusted me with. "May I ask you something, Raymond?" I said. He slurped his cola and nodded. I looked away again. The man who had served us was lounging at the counter, nodding his head in time with the music. It was a cacophonous din with too many guitars and not enough melody. It was, I thought, the sound of madness, the kind of music that lunatics hear in their heads just before they slice the heads off foxes and throw them into their neighbour's back garden. "I've been offered a promotion to the position of office manager," I said. "Do you think I should accept?" He stopped chomping and took another slurp of his drink.
"Well, that's brilliant, Eleanor," he said, smiling. "What's stopping you?"
I had a nibble of my scone. It was unexpectedly delicious, much nicer than the ones you get in Tesco. I never thought I'd find myself thinking that about anything. "Well," I said, "on the plus side, I would get paid more money, not a huge amount more, but still enough to allow me to upgrade on certain items. On the other hand, it would entail more work and more responsibility. and the office is largely staffed by shirkers and idiots, Raymond. Managing them and their workloads would be quite a challenge, I can assure you. He snorted with laughter, then coughed. It appeared that his cola had gone down the wrong way.
I see your point, he said.
What it boils down to is the extra money worth the extra hassle? Quite, I said. You've summarised my dilemma very neatly. He paused, chomped some more. What's your game plan, Eleanor? He asked. I had no idea what he meant, which must have been evident from my facial expression. What I mean is, do you plan to stay in office administration long term? If you do, it could be good, a new title and salary. When you come to take the next step, you'll be in a much better position. What do you mean, next step? I said. The man was incapable of speaking in plain English. When you apply for another job with another company, I mean, he explained, waving his fork around. I shrank back, fearful that some micro-spots of spittle might reach me.
Well, you don't want to work at By Design forever, do you? He said. You're, what, 26, 27?
I recently turned 30, Raymond, I said, surprisingly pleased.
Really?
He said.
Well, you're not planning to spend the rest of your life doing Bob's books, are you?
I shrugged. I genuinely hadn't given it a moment's thought.
I suppose so, I said.
What else would I do?
Eleanor, he said, shocked for some reason. You're bright, you're conscientious, you're very well organised, he said. There are lots of other jobs you could do.
Really? I said, dubious.
Sure, he said, nodding vigorously. I mean, you're numerate, right? You're well-spoken. Do you know any other languages?
I nodded. I have a very good grasp of Latin, actually, I said. He pursed his whiskery little mouth.
Hmm, he said, gesturing to the waiter who came over and cleared our table.
He returned with two coffees and an unrequested saucer of chocolate truffles. Enjoy, guys, he said, placing the dish with a flourish. I shook my head, not believing that anyone would actually say such a thing. Raymond returned to his theme.
There are lots of places that would be looking to hire an experienced office manager, Eleanor, he said. Not just graphic design. Could be a GP practice or an IT company or, well, loads of places.
He shoved a truffle in his mouth.
Do you want to stay in Glasgow? You could move to Edinburgh or London or... Well, the world's your oyster, really, isn't it?
Is it? I said. Again, it had never crossed my mind to move cities, live somewhere else. Bath, with its fabulous Roman remains. York. London. It was all a bit too much. It occurs to me that there are many things in life that I've never considered doing, Raymond. I suppose I hadn't realised that I had any control over them. That sounds ridiculous, I know, I said. He looked very serious and leaned forward.
Eleanor, it can't have been easy for you.
You don't have any brothers or sisters, your dad's never been around, and you said that you have quite a difficult relationship with your mum? I nodded.
Are you seeing anyone at the moment? He asked.
Yes, I said. He looked expectant, bizarrely. He seemed to require a more detailed response than this. I sighed, shook my head. I spoke as slowly and clearly as I could. I'm seeing you right now, Raymond. You're sitting right in front of me. He snorted with laughter.
You know fine well what I mean, Eleanor.
It became apparent that I didn't.
Have you got a boyfriend? He said patiently.
I hesitated. No, well, there is someone, but no, I suppose the factually correct answer at this point in time is no, for the time being at least.
So you have a lot to deal with on your own, he said, not as a question, but as a statement of fact.
You shouldn't give yourself a hard time for not having a 10-year career plan.
Do you have a 10-year career plan? I asked. It seemed unlikely. Nah, he said, smiling. Does anybody? Anybody normal, I mean?
I shrugged. I'm not really sure I know any normal people, I said.
None taken, Eleanor, he said, laughing.
I pondered this, then realised what he meant. I didn't mean any offence, Raymond, I said. Sorry.
Don't be daft, he said, gesturing for the bill. So when do you have to decide about the job?
I think you should take it for what it's worth, he said.
Nothing ventured, eh? Plus, I'm sure you'd make a great office manager.
I looked at him closely, waiting for a follow-up remark or a snide comment, but much to my surprise, neither was forthcoming. He took out his wallet and paid the bill. I protested vehemently, but he flat-out refused to allow me to contribute my share.
"You only had a coffee and a scone," he said. "You can buy me lunch when you get your first office manager's paycheck."
He smiled. I thanked him. No one had ever bought me lunch before. It was a very pleasant feeling to have someone incur expenditure on my behalf, voluntarily, expecting nothing in return. The hour was up just as we got back to the office building, and so we said a brief goodbye before returning to our respective desks. This was the first day in 9 years that I'd eaten lunch with a companion and that I hadn't done the crossword. Strangely, I felt no concern about the crossword whatsoever. Perhaps I'd do it this evening instead. Perhaps I'd simply recycle the newspaper without even attempting it. As Raymond had pointed out, the world was full of infinite possibility. I opened my email and typed him a message. Dear R, thank you very much for lunch. Kind regards, E. I suppose it made sense, in a way, shortening the names. It was obvious who was addressing whom, after all. He replied quickly.
No worries. Good luck with your decision. See you Saturday. R.
Life felt like it was moving very fast indeed at the moment, a whirlwind of possibilities. I hadn't even thought about the musician this afternoon. I logged onto my computer and started researching venues for the Christmas lunch. This was going to be quite the event, I decided. It would be unlike any other Christmas lunch. It would be important to eschew cliché and precedent. I would do something different, something that would surprise and delight my co-workers, subvert their expectations. It wouldn't be easy. One thing I knew for certain was this. Bob's £10 budget would be the basis of the event, and no one would need to contribute further. I still resented all the monetary payments I'd been forced to make over the years to have a terrible time in a terrible place with terrible people on the last Friday before the 25th of December. After all, how hard could it be? Raymond had really been most encouraging over lunch. If I could perform Scansion on the Aeneid, if I could build a macro in an Excel spreadsheet, if I could spend the last 9 birthdays and Christmases and New Year's Eves alone, then I'm sure I could manage to organise a delightful festive lunch for 30 people on a budget of £10 per capita. Chapter 20. Saturday morning passed in a blur of household chores. I'd started wearing rubber gloves to protect my hands, and although unsightly, they were helping. The ugliness didn't matter. After all, there was no one to see me. Gathering up the detritus of the previous evening, I noticed that I had failed to consume all of my vodka allocation. The best part of a half bottle of Smirnoff was extant. Mindful of my gauche faux pas at Laura's party, I put it in a Tesco carrier bag to present to Keith tonight. I pondered what else I should take for him. Flowers seemed wrong. They're a love token, after all. I looked in the fridge and popped a packet of cheese slices into the bag. All men like cheese. I arrived 5 minutes early at the train station nearest to the party venue. Mirabile dictu, Raymond was already there. He waved at me and I waved back. We set off towards the golf club. Raymond walked quickly and I began to worry that I wouldn't be able to keep pace with him in my new boots. I noticed him glance at me and then he slowed his steps to match mine. I realised that such small gestures, the way his mother had made me a cup of tea after our meal without asking, remembering that I didn't take sugar, the way Laura had placed 2 little biscuits on the saucer when she brought me coffee in the salon, Such things could mean so much. I wondered how it would feel to perform such simple deeds for other people. I couldn't remember. I had done such things in the past, tried to be kind, tried to take care. I knew that I had, but that was before. I tried, and I had failed, and all was lost to me afterwards. I had no one to blame but myself. It was quiet out in the suburbs. The views were open, with no tenements or high-rise blocks to obscure the distant hills. The light was soft and gentle. Summer was drifting ever onwards, and the evening seemed delicate, fragile. We walked in silence, the kind that you didn't feel the need to fill. I was almost sad when we arrived at the squat white clubhouse. It was halfway to dark by then, with both a moon and a sun sitting high in a sky that was sugar almond pink and shot with gold. The birds were singing valiantly against the coming night, swooping over the greens in long, drunken loops. The air was grassy with a hint of flowers and earth, and the warm, sweet outbreath of the day sighed gently into our hair and over our skin. I felt like asking Raymond whether we should keep walking. Walk over the rolling greens, keep walking till the birds fell silent in their bowers, and we could see only by starlight. It almost felt like he might suggest it himself. The front door to the clubhouse burst open, and three children came running out, laughing at the tops of their voices, one wielding a plastic sword.
"Here we are, then," said Raymond, softly.
It was an odd venue for a social gathering. The corridors were lined with notice boards, all pinned with impenetrable messages about ladders and tea times. A wooden panel at the end of the entrance hall bore a long list of men's names in golden letters, starting in 1924 and ending, this year, somewhat improbably, with a Dr. Terry Berry. The decor was a discomforting mix of institutional, a look with which I'm very familiar, and outdated family home. Nasty patterned curtains, hard-wearing floors, dusty dried flower arrangements. When we walked into the function suite, we were met with a wall of sound. A mobile discotheque had been set up, and the floor was already packed with dancers, ages ranging from 5 to 80, all illuminated randomly by some unimpressive coloured lights. The dancers seemed to be pretending to ride a horse in time to the music. I looked up at Raymond, very much out of my depth.
"Christ," he said, "I need a drink."
I followed him gratefully to the bar. The prices were gratifyingly low, and I drank my Magnus quite fast, comfortable in the knowledge that I'd brought enough money for several more, although Raymond had, despite my protests, purchased this one. We found a table as far away from the source of the noise as possible.
"Family dues," Raymond said, shaking his head. "It's bad enough when it's your own family, when it's someone else's."
I looked around. I had no prior experience of such events, and the main thing that struck me was disparity, age range, social class, and the sartorial choices made by the guests.
"You can choose your friends,"
Raymond said, toasting me with his pint glass. "But you can't choose your family," I replied, delighted to be in a position to complete the well-known phrase. It was only a quick crossword clue, not a cryptic one, but still.
"This is exactly like my dad's 50th, mum's 60th, my sister's wedding,"
Raymond said.
"A shite DJ, overexcited kids high on sugar, people who haven't seen each other for years catching up and pretending they like each other. Bet you anything there'll be a buffet with vol-au-vents and a fight in the car park at closing time."
I was intrigued. "But surely it must be fun," I said, "catching up with family. All those people pleased to see you, interested in your life." He looked at me carefully.
"Do you know what, Eleanor? It is. I'm just being a grumpy bastard. Sorry."
He finished his pint.
"Same again?" he said.
I nodded and then remembered. No, it's my turn," I said. "Will you have the same again?" He smiled.
"That'd be great. Thanks, Eleanor."
I picked up my shopper and made my way to the bar. I caught Sammy's eye en route. He was sitting in an armchair surrounded by friends and family members, as usual. I went over.
"Eleanor, love," he said. "How are you? Great party."
I nodded.
"I can't believe my wee boy's 40. It seems like yesterday he was off to school for his first day. You should see the photo. He's got no front teeth, the wee scamp. And look at him now."
He pointed across the room to where Keith was standing with his wife, their arms round one another's waists, laughing at something an older man was saying.
"That's all you ever want for your kids, for them to be happy. I just wish my Jean was here to see it."
I pondered this. Was that what people wanted for their children, for them to be happy? It certainly sounded plausible. I asked Sam if I could purchase a drink for him, although he did, to my inexpert eye, already seem somewhat intoxicated.
"You're fine, hen," he said. "I've already got these waiting for me."
The table was covered with short glasses of amber liquid. I said I'd see him again later and went to the bar. There was quite a queue, but I was enjoying the atmosphere. Blessed relief, the DJ was taking a break, and I could see him over in the corner, swigging from a can and talking morosely into his mobile telephone. There was a background hum of noise, male and female voices and a lot of laughter. The children seemed to have multiplied and had gravitated towards one another in order to form a merry band of mischief-makers. It was clear that the adults were all occupied with the party, so they could run and whoop and chase each other with unsupervised abandon. I smiled at them, envied them slightly. All the people in the room seemed to take so much for granted. That they would be invited to social events, that they would have friends and family to talk to, that they would fall in love, be loved in return, perhaps create a family of their own. How would I celebrate my own 40th birthday, I wondered. I hoped I would have people in my life to mark the occasion with me when the time came. Perhaps the musician, the light of my new life? One thing was certain, however, I would not, under any circumstances, be celebrating in a golf club. When I returned to our table, it was empty. I put Raymond's pint down and sipped my Magnus. I supposed he'd found someone more interesting to talk to. I sat and watched the dancing. The DJ was back behind the decks and had selected a cacophonous racket from a silver box of records, something about a man after midnight. I allowed my mind to wander. I found this to be a very effective way of passing the time. You take a situation or a person and start to imagine nice things that might happen. You can make anything happen, anything at all, inside a daydream. I felt a hand on my shoulder and jumped.
"Sorry," Raymond said. "I nipped to the gents, got talking to someone on the way back."
I felt the heat where his hand had been. It was only a moment, but it left a warm imprint, almost as though it might be visible. A human hand was exactly the right weight, exactly the right temperature for touching another person, I realised. I'd shaken hands a fair bit over the years, more so recently, but I hadn't been touched in a lifetime. Of course, Declan and I had had regular sexual intercourse whenever he wanted to, but he had never really touched me. He made me touch him, told me how and when and where, and I did so. I had no choice in the matter, but I remembered feeling like another person at those times, like it wasn't my hand, like it wasn't my body. It was simply a case of waiting for it to be over. I was 30 years old, I realised, and I had never walked hand in hand with anyone. No one had ever rubbed my tired shoulders or stroked my face. I imagined a man putting his arms around me and holding me close when I was sad or tired or upset. The warmth of it. The weight of it.
"Eleanor," Raymond said.
"Sorry, I was miles away," I said, sipping my Magnus.
"Seems to be going well,"
he said, gesturing around the room. I nodded.
"I was chatting to Sammy's other son, Gary, and his girlfriend," he said. "They had a good laugh."
I looked around again. What would it be like in future, going to events like this on the arm of the musician? He'd make sure I was comfortable, dance with me if I wanted to,
unlikely,
and make friends with the other guests. And then, at the end of the evening, we'd slip away together, home, to nest like turtle doves. We seem to be the only people here who aren't part of a couple, I told him, having observed the other guests. He screwed up his face.
Hi. Listen, thanks for coming with me. It's shite going to stuff like this on your own, isn't it?
Is it? I said, interested. I don't have a control situation to compare it with.
He looked at me. You've always been on your own, then? He said. You mentioned that guy last week. The one that... I saw him reach for words. The one that you were with when you were at uni.
As you know, I was with Declan for a couple of years, I said. And you also know how that turned out.
More Magnus.
You get used to being on your own, I said. Actually, it really is much better than being punched in the face or raped.
Raymond choked on his pint and took a moment to recover himself. He spoke very gently. You do realise, Eleanor, that those are not your only options, don't you? Not all men are like Declan, you know.
I do know, I said brightly. I've met one. In my mind's eye, I saw the musician bringing me freesias, kissing the nape of my neck.
Raymond looked uncomfortable for some reason. I'll just nip to the bar, he said. You still on the Magners?
I felt strange, stirred up. I'll have a vodka with cola, please, I said, knowing from experience that vodka would be good for whatever ailed me.
I watched Raymond shuffle off.
If only he would stand up straight and shave. He needed to buy some nice shirts and some proper shoes and read a book or two instead of playing computer games. How could he ever hope to find a nice girl otherwise? Heath came up to the table and thanked me for coming. I gave him his birthday present, which he seemed to find genuinely surprising. He looked at each item in turn with an expression that I found hard to read, but I quickly eliminated boredom and indifference. I felt happy. It was a nice feeling giving someone a gift, the kind of unique, thoughtful present that he wouldn't have received from anyone else. He put the carrier bag on a nearby table.
Would you like to dance, Eleanor?
My heart started to pump faster. Dance? Could I? I'm not sure I know how, I said. Keith laughed and pulled me to my feet.
Come on, he said. You'll be fine.
We'd only just reached the wooden dancing area when the music changed, and he groaned.
Oh, I'm sorry, he said, but there's no way. I'm going to have to sit this one out. Birthday boy privileges.
I watched as some people left the dance floor and others flocked to take their place.
The music had a lot of brass instruments and a fast beat. Michelle, Gary's girlfriend, beckoned me over and pulled me into a small group of women around the same age who smiled at me and looked very happy. I joined in with what seemed to be jigging on the spot. Some people moved their arms as though they were jogging. Some people were pointing at nothing. It appeared that you were supposed to move your body around in any way you saw fit, as long as it was in time with the music, which was a steady 8 beats, helpfully marked out by a drum. Then the beat changed abruptly, and everyone started doing the same thing, making strange shapes with their arms above their head. It took me a moment or two to learn the shapes, and then I was able to copy them. Free-form jigging, communal shapes in the air, free-form jigging, communal shapes in the air. Dancing was easy. I found myself not thinking about anything, sort of like how the vodka worked, but different because I was with people and I was singing. Y-M-C-A. Y-M-C-A. Arms in the air, mimicking the letters. What a marvellous idea. Who knew that dancing could be so logical? During the next free-form jigging section, I started to wonder why the band was singing about, presumably, the Young Men's Christian Association. But then, from my very limited exposure to popular music, people did seem to sing about umbrellas and fire-starting and Emily Bronte novels, so I supposed why not a gender and faith-based youth organisation. The song finished and another one began. This one was not nearly so much fun, being entirely free-form jigging with no communal arm patterns in between. But nevertheless, I remained on the dance floor with the same group of smiling women, feeling that I was in the swing of things now. I was beginning to understand why people might find dancing enjoyable, although I wasn't sure I could manage an entire evening of it. I felt a quick tap on my shoulder and turned round, expecting Raymond to be there, a smile ready as I thought how he'd like to hear about the arm-shape dance. But it wasn't him. It was a man in his mid to late 30s, whom I'd never met before. He smiled and raised his eyebrows, like a question, and then simply started free-form jigging in front of me. I turned back to the group of smiling women, but the circle had reformed without me. The man, red-faced, short, with the pasty look of someone who has never eaten an apple, continued to jig enthusiastically, if somewhat unrhythmically. At a loss as how to respond, I resumed my dancing. He leaned forward and said something, which naturally was rendered inaudible by the volume of the music.
"I beg your pardon," I shouted. "I said," he shouted, much louder than before, "how do you know Keith?"
What a bizarre question to ask a stranger.
"I assisted his father when he had an accident," I said.
I had to repeat this twice before the man understood. Perhaps he had some sort of hearing impairment. When it had finally penetrated, he looked intrigued. He lunged forward towards me with what I could only describe as a leer.
"Are you a nurse?"
he said.
"No," I said. "I'm a finance administration assistant."
He seemed to be at a bit of a loss for words after that, and I looked ceilingwards as we jigged in order to discourage further conversation. It was quite challenging to dance and speak at the same time. When the song ended, I'd had enough for the time being, and felt in fairly urgent need of refreshment.
"Can I get you a drink?"
the man yelled over the top of the next song. I wondered whether the DJ had ever considered introducing a 5-minute break between records to allow people to go to the bar or the lavatory in peace. Perhaps I should suggest that to him later.
"No, thank you," I said. "I don't want to accept a drink from you because then I would be obliged to purchase one for you in return, and I'm afraid I'm simply not interested in spending 2 drinks worth of time with you." "Eh?" he said,
cupping his hand around his ear. Clearly he had tinnitus or some other hearing impairment. I communicated via mime, simply shaking my head and waving my index finger while mouthing, "No." I turned around and went in search of the lavatory before he attempted any further conversation. It was difficult to find, located down a corridor, and I could only see signs for a powder room. This, it eventually transpired, meant lavatories. Why don't people just call things what they are? It's confusing. There was a queue, which I joined, standing behind a very inebriated woman who was dressed inappropriately for her age. I do feel that tube tops are best suited to the under-25s, if indeed they are suited to anyone. A sheer, sparkly jacket was doing an inadequate job of covering up her enormous, crepey bosom. Her makeup, which would have been subtle had it been intended for a stage performance in the Royal Albert Hall, had started to run. For some reason, I could imagine this woman sobbing on the stairs at the end of the night. I surprised myself with the insight, but there was something rather febrile about her demeanour which led one to this conclusion.
"How much of your life do you think you've wasted queuing for the bogs?" she asked conversationally. "They never have enough of them, do they?"
I didn't speak, as I was trying to calculate the approximate queuing time, but she didn't seem to mind that I hadn't responded.
"It's all right for the men, isn't it?" she went on, in an angry tone. "There's never a queue for the gents. Sometimes I feel like just going in there, squatting over the urinal." "Ha!" she said. "Imagine their faces."
She laughed, a long, smoky laugh that turned into a protracted cough. "Oh, but I think it would be terribly unhygienic in the gentlemen's toilets," I said. "They don't seem to mind so much about cleanliness and that sort of thing."
"No," she said, her voice full of bitterness. "They just come in, piss everywhere, and then waltz off, leaving someone else to clean up after them.
She gazed unsteadily off into the distance, clearly with a specific individual in mind.
I feel quite sorry for them, actually, I said.
She glared at me, and I hurried to clarify my statement.
I mean, imagine having to micturate in a row alongside other men, strangers, acquaintances, friends even. It must be dreadful.
Just think how odd it would be if we had to display our genitals to one another when we finally reached the front of this queue. She belched, very gently, and stared with uninhibited frankness at my scars. I turned my head away.
"You're a bit mental, aren't you?"
she said, not in the least aggressively, but slurring her words somewhat. It was hardly the first time I'd heard this.
"Yes," I said. "Yes, I suppose I am."
She nodded, like I had confirmed a long-held suspicion. We didn't talk after that. When I returned to the function suite, the mood had changed. The pace of the music was slower. I went to the bar and bought myself a Magners and a vodka and cola, and after a moment's thought, a pint of beer for Raymond. It was quite tricky to carry it all back to our little table, but I managed without spilling a drop. I was glad to sit down after all the jigging and queuing, and finished my vodka in two gulps. Dancing was thirsty work. Raymond's denim coat was still slung over the back of his chair, but there was no sign of him. I thought he had perhaps gone outside to smoke. I had a lot to tell him, about the dancing, about the queue lady, and I was looking forward to doing so. The music changed again and was now even slower. Lots of people left the floor, and those who remained drifted together. It was a strange sight, like something from the natural world, monkeys perhaps, or birds. The women all put their arms around the men's necks, and the men put their arms around the women's waists. They swayed from side to side, shuffling their feet awkwardly, either looking into one another's faces or else resting their heads on each other's shoulders. It was some sort of mating ritual, clearly. But then might it not be quite pleasurable to sway in time to slow music, pressed close against someone rather wonderful? I looked at them all again, the various sizes and shapes and permutations of them. And there, in the middle, was Raymond, dancing with Laura. He was speaking into her ear close enough to be able to smell her perfume. She was laughing. The drink I'd bought him was going to go to waste. I picked it up and drank it down, the whole pint, acrid and bitter tasting. I stood up and put on my jerkin. I'd visit the powder room one more time, and then I would get the train back into town. The party, it seemed, was over. Chapter 21 Monday. Things didn't feel right. I hadn't been able to relax yesterday, hadn't been able to settle to anything. I just felt on edge somehow. If my mood was a crossword clue, the answer would be discombobulated. I tried to think why, but was unable to arrive at a plausible conclusion. I'd ended up taking the bus into town in the afternoon, free of charge, thank you, travel pass, and gone back to see Bobby Brown. Once again, Ms. Brown herself had failed to report for duty. I feared her work ethic was somewhat lacking, and a different lady had made me up, almost the same as last time. On this occasion, I'd purchased the multiple products and tools required to recreate the same face at home. The total cost exceeded my monthly council tax bill by some margin, but I was in such a strange mood that this did not deter me. I kept the painted face on all day, and had reapplied it this morning, in an almost exact facsimile. The lady had shown me what to do, including the careful blending of concealer over my scars. The smoky eye was a bit uneven today, but that, she had said, was the beauty of a smoky eye. It didn't need to be precise. I'd forgotten I'd done it until I got to the office, and Billy whistled, a wolf whistle, in fact, which made the others turn and look.
"You here, Betty Lippy?"
he said, nudging me with his elbow. I shrank back.
"Somebody's hoping to get hersel a bit of action, if I'm no mistaken."
The women gathered round. I was wearing my new outfit, too. You look lovely, Eleanor. Black really suits you. I love those boots. Where did you get them? I examined their faces, looking out for sly glances, waiting for a punchline. None was forthcoming. Where did you